Welcome to Project Apology. My name is Areej Elmi, and I'm your host. Over the next 40 minutes or so, you're going to hear the story of a young Muslim woman in Canada who has experienced trauma in her relationship with a parent. In the episode, you will hear her read a letter that she has written from the perspective of a parent. You'll then hear her provide some context of the letter and share how she is coping with the consequences of the trauma in her life. Before we begin, I'd like to give you a content warning. We touch on many difficult subjects in these episodes, including sexual abuse, disordered eating, physical abuse, and neglect. This material can be hard to hear. It was certainly hard for me to hear at times, and it was harder still for the women to live through. If you need to take a break while listening, do so. And if you need support, please go to our website, www.projectapology.com, where we have a number of resources listed for counseling and family violence. Episode 7, I decided to rebel against the illogical logic of things. Meet the brilliant Dadu. Dadu invokes Ghada As-Samman, the Syrian poet who commits to rebelling against the illogical logic of things. Dadu rebels against many illogical things in her life: anti-Black racism, anti-Muslim hostility, sexism. Violence comes from all directions, and she learns to be at peace with herself and at peace in her relationship with her mother. Life has been a tough journey for Dadu. She faced discrimination against her in her North African home country for the sin of being Black and for being the daughter of a divorcee. And yet, she retains a romantic notion for herself. She dreams. She fantasizes. She escapes. It's a beautiful episode, and I joyfully share it with you now. Here is Dadu reading her letter.
My dear little girl, as you may know, my life hasn't been an easy ride after my divorce from your father, whom I loved dearly and even begged him not to divorce me. The anger I felt when he decided to divorce me was so great that I did not realize I was harming you more than your sister. I was never aware of my own harmful actions towards you, but know something that I regretted deeply, and I know fully well how my abuse had an impact on you. Although I was not fully I hadn't fully grasped it, because I always ignored the deep reasons for me physically and mentally abusing you. I am sad that my actions have affected you deeply, mainly in your personality, and how it has grown to be, and how you have grown to be fragile and sensitive. I'm proud of your achievements. You realized my dream of becoming a journalist, as I no longer fear for you, as I have always done, by overprotecting you. You know how our society is very judgmental towards me as a divorcee with two girls. Now I have done my bit. I brought you up to become the woman that you are today. I no longer fear for you, because you will face the difficulties as a man, your mama.
What are you feeling right now? Because I'm seeing emotion in your face.
I don't know how to describe it, but I feel that this is the first time I write down what my mother has told me in the last few years, like, about what she felt towards me and the type of abuse she has put on me. I feel happy that I've written this letter. I wish my mother could read it, but I know she's not the type of person. She's very proud to go over something to go over the past. And I think she's right in some ways. I'm someone who tries to get over the past, you know, to go over the past and try to bring back, you know, the painful memories of the past. Mm-hmm. So that's why I translated them in as best as I can. Mm. And I'm happy that she said that, because that showed me that my mother loved me. Mm-hmm. Because I have always thought that my mother never loved me. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that loving was through words. Mm-hmm. But I deeply think that my mother was the person who loved me the most. Mm-hmm. Because she only did actions. Mm-hmm. And almost never said the word, I love you. Mm-hmm. So that part was... the fact that she never said, I love you, that made me doubt all my life that she never loved me. But now I think I'm blessed by God that I had someone who loved me in her own way, by letting me do things that no other mother would allow her daughter to do it. Mm-hmm. The fact that I'm here in Canada, that I decided to pursue my dreams, she never, she always encouraged me to do whatever I felt, you know, was the best for me. Yeah.
You mentioned in the letter, it was her dream to be a journalist and you're fulfilling it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. That's something she wasn't able to do.
Yes. Because of traditions at the time, because her father was very conservative and he wanted her to be a teacher. And my mother made us, or at least made me, listen to the radio since I was little. She made us, at the time, listen to Deutsche Welle. And then the BBC, and she was the one behind me learning English from a very young age, when I was a teenager. So I deeply feel grateful to her for having chosen, you know, my destiny in some ways. Mm-hmm. Sometimes against my will, because mm-hmm. I didn't want to choose English at the time. I wanted to do political science like my dad. So thank you, Mom, for having, you know, pushed me to study English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in a lot of ways, she shaped sort of where you are now.
She did, in a lot of ways, because in the absence of a father, she had to play the father and the mother, and that was something really hard for her. I didn't mention that in my letter, but my mother was my father, too. My father was almost absent because he used to live quite far, and so we would see him sometimes, maybe my sister, maybe 3 to 4 times a year. So my mother was like the father of the house, so she was someone whose presence was quite imposing. Sometimes when I hear some people complain about their father, and I'm like, I wish I had a father like you guys. But I had a nurturing father in some ways, who was very protective, but at the same time loving in their own way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so Mom taking on, like you said, both of those roles.
Yeah.
What was the relationship like between your parents?
It was very bad, sadly. Mm-hmm. Even though my parents, after the divorce, my parents divorced when I was 3 years old, and my father didn't see us for at least maybe a year and a half. When he came to see us after that period of time, me and my sister, we didn't recognize him. We were so scared because we thought that this person was not our father. He cried a lot. He mm-hmm. thought that, you know, my mother did it on purpose. And she said to him, well, you left us. You left your daughters. What do you expect? And so he tried to make up for his absence. He tried to be as present as possible. I have to say, my father also shaped me in some ways. Since I was little, he made me love, you know, his career. He was a political science professor. So when I was, since the age of 10, 12, I was into, you know, international affairs and watching TV and about learning about international relations and the Palestinian cause. He was very loving. I was his favorite. To some extent that my sister was a bit jealous, because he was happy that I was also his copy, you know. Mm-hmm. So my parents reconciled after that. My mother, unfortunately, she was nurturing the dream of going back to my father. And I never understood why my parents divorced. Never. I thought that Maybe because you know, the problem is they will never tell you the truth, you know, parents, you know, maybe they do that, they did that, you know, to protect you. But my mother always blamed him, and in some ways she kind of never forgave him for having left her. So I have to say it wasn't an easy divorce for her. So at one time she tried to influence us, or put us against our father, because she couldn't get over that divorce. It was so hard for her to accept that reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what was that like for mom to tell you that? How old would you have been when mom was sharing that with you?
I mean, since we were little, I mean, my mother always blamed, you know, my father, mm-hmm. for the divorce, for everything. And she was unable to let it down. She, unfortunately, couldn't. Hold, you know, that anger in her towards him. And she was at one time kind of manipulative in the way of making us, me and my sister, blame our father for the divorce. And I know my father, that before he died, he would tell us, you know, that he regretted maybe that he divorced my mother, but it was the only way, because he was not happy with her. So we were caught in this manipulation game, mm-hmm. mainly from my mother. That's one of the reasons why at one time I was angry at with her because of that. But I understand her, you know, after many years when we had to talk about this whole pain of the divorce, and that she was not aware that she was harming both of us. Mm-hmm. But she still thinks that he was so unfair towards her by divorcing her. So she always maintained that she was right and he was wrong.
Yeah.
Even today, she still thinks that he was wrong. But I think that's because of the pain. I'm not trying to justify, but you know, I love psychology and I read a lot of psychological books, so I'm trying to understand the type of my mother's character and personality. And I think the pain made her try to find a scapegoat, and the only scapegoat was my father. I remember at one time my mother would curse my father even after he died, because she was so pained and no one wanted to understand her because of how life was so unfair to her. No one listened to her version, I mean, of the story. Again, I still don't know what was going on between them, because again, the story that both of them were telling us, you know, was from their own perspective. So it's very hard to tell who was right, who was wrong, you know.
When you say, like, no one was willing to listen to her story, who is no one? Is it her parents, her family?
Her family, but mainly his family, who never liked her. I mean, who never appreciated her.
Okay. Yeah. So I want to also learn about the impacts. Right. So you mentioned earlier when we were chatting, there's a feeling of I struggle to have relationships, right, because of this earlier relationship with my mom. So can you talk more about what the legacy has been of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's the fear of commitment. Because my mother at one time, she, because of her... her divorce was considered as a failure for her as a mother, as a wife, as a woman. So she was totally shattered. And that affected me a lot, that I couldn't be a good mother. I could never be a good lover or a good wife. And that also kind of made it very hard for me to commit to to someone because of my past, very hard past to deal with, especially when you come from, again, a divorcee background in an Arab country. Though I have to say that things have changed in my home country of Tunisia, where being a divorcee is no longer something to be ashamed of. Ironically, my sister, she married someone. She divorced after a month, and then she remarried, and now she's happy with 3 children with someone else. So, but then again, it's all about, I no longer fear being committed. My only fear is having someone. Before he loves me, he needs to accept me with my faults, with my past, and not to judge me in the same way my mother was judged by society.
Mm-hmm. And how did you see mom getting judged?
Well, being a divorcee in the 1980s in the south of Tunisia was considered as almost a haram thing, like something against religion. Something that was considered extremely taboo. And because my mother had to break that taboo by deciding to go and live with her on her own with her 2 daughters away from her family, because when a woman divorces in the south of Tunisia, she has to stay with her family. My mother just was a revolutionary, rebellious person. She decided to leave everything behind, run away from her family, took us to the north of Tunisia, and she decided not to see her family ever since. So that was the boldest, you know, move that she did, because she wanted always to be free and independent from people's, you know, judgment. And it was very hard for her, you know, to live as a divorcee in such a society that was judging her on a daily basis. But I think with time, people learn to be less judgmental, at least, you know, her immediate family, when they saw that, her escape from such a conservative and stifling environment was, a salvation for her, but also for her daughters, because they were expecting her daughters, you know, to be led astray and not to, and to probably engage in a non-Islamic, you know, lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a battle for her. Mm-hmm. Against this society, and she won that battle when she brought up two women who were very successful. So for her, I think she, in some ways, she succeeded as a divorcee and as a woman. Mm-hmm. And that kind of made her feel proud of her achievements, you know, despite the deep wounds. Mm-hmm. Of being a divorcee.
So she's very much, it sounds like, surpassed these negative expectations.
Yeah.
That other.
Yeah.
People had for what her life would amount to, and also what you and your sister.
Yeah.
Could amount to. They didn't expect much.
Yeah, of course, I wouldn't expect anything from her, because for her, because, you know, when you come from a patriarchal society, a woman is nothing without a man, without a male, I should say. Mm-hmm. And so my mother was the man of the house, and she had to play the man in an aggressively racist and patriarchal society. Yeah. Now, I guess things have changed a lot, but she still, you know, carries the wounds, and I do carry the wounds of people looking down on her and on us, because we were the divorcee's daughters. Yeah. Being a divorcee's daughters in the south of Tunisia amounts to an insult at the time. It's like using the N-word. Mm-hmm. To call someone, or calling a Muslim a terrorist. That was the deepest wound that my mother had to carry, and I still carry sometimes, I mean, until today, even though, mm-hmm. I learned, you know, to get over it, but I still hold a tiny, tiny grudge against those. Yeah. People who were calling us that. Mm-hmm. The D word, I call it.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering too, because mom, she's a black woman in Tunisia. Did that complicate her experience as a divorcee?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. It was terrible.
How so? How
did it was blackness... terrible. It was very bad. My mother is darker than me, so that's even worse.
Okay.
But I admired that my mother was someone who is very vocal, who was physically quite tough, you know, like she was quite buxom and she was always ready for a fight. She's always my opposite. Whenever she was attacked or physically abused, I mean, not physically, but, you know, abused, you know, verbally speaking, she would just go into a tirade and she starts, you know, yelling and calling people names and, you know, using swear words. She would take her own justice, you know, by her hand. She would never needed a policeman or a man just to go and take in and, you know, defend her. So in that, I admired her, even though at one time I felt so ashamed that she would yell so much that people would call her the angry black woman. And I studied a lot about the syndrome of the angry black woman. And I sometimes feel like, you know, this was the impact of, you know, post-slave societies in the Americas, where you have this single black woman who had to struggle on her own in a racist society. And were it not for that, for her tough personality, my mother probably would have collapsed and probably suffered a probably deep depression. I could have probably committed suicide, but she alhamdulillah was quite tough in not letting racism in any of the discrimination, you know, touch her, because she had to survive in a violent society. Unlike me, who struggled to survive in that violent society, the reason why I chose to run away from that society.
Mm-hmm. But the only way, like you said, that she has survived is because she stood up and...
Yeah, and she had to fight. She had to fight, you know, even sometimes physically speaking.
Yeah.
She had really to fight, you know, when say physically, you know, she would tell us once about an episode when she had to grab someone by his genitals because he wanted, you know, to abuse her. Like she felt like when coming from a society that treats you like not even second class, it's like an underclass, being a black in Tunisia, she felt like, you know, there's no justice, you know. The only way for her to be able to impose respect in a society that is racist is to fight for her own justice and not wait for anyone to do that, because as a black person, the system is against you, the establishment is against you, the state is against you. So the only way to fight back is to fight back, no one else. And that's something that I have always lacked, this kind of courage to go and fight back, because I was too weak to fight back. My mother was not, my sister was not. They were very strong and in the way that they were resilient enough not to let, you know, them let this society crush them.
Mm-hmm. And has that changed at any point in your life, or do you continue to feel more hesitant?
It has, even though I prefer to escape and avoid, because I'm not a violent person by nature, unlike my mother, who had to become violent to survive. Because and one of the reasons why I couldn't take that path, because I felt that violence would only breed violence, and I chose to escape such a violent society. But I felt that there was so much anger in myself that I needed to channel it through something. And this is how I came to practice yoga, to get that anger. But most of all, it's about avoidance. When I'm angry at the people who hurt me the most, I'm talking here about a lot of Tunisians, is to avoid them.
Mm. In Tunisia or
even here? Okay. Even more here. Yeah. I try to avoid them as best as I can.
Yeah.
Because they carry, I see the racist system in them, mm-hmm. sadly.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean you see the racist system in them?
I see maybe probably say can I may some say something extreme, but you know, it's the same type of feeling maybe some Holocaust survivors they have when they see a Nazi in front of them. That's yeah. how I feel when I see white Tunisians in front of me.
Yeah,
which I is, just I freak out.
Yeah, which is sometimes. Like a genocidal violence.
Yes, yeah. absolutely, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sadly, but you know, I'm not ashamed of saying that. I could have been ashamed, you know, maybe 11 years ago, but now I think because Tunisia was blessed to have gone through something beautiful called the revolution, so I know a lot of my Tunisian friends will understand my feeling because I know the type of racist society they were brought up in. A lot of them, they left the country because not only because of that, but because of how a seemingly peaceful society could breed, you know, so much violence and hate sometimes. I mean, symbolic violence, of course, mm-hmm. between different, you know, communities, yeah. in particular, you know, between the Black community and the non-Black community.
So what would be an example of that symbolic violence that you felt?
That you're always a second-class citizen, that you will never get anywhere because you're Black, that you're destined to be always beneath the light-skinned white Tunisian person, that there are some traditions and some you know certain taboos regarding, for instance, you know, interracial marriage. That's something that is not only big no-no, almost making it something haram. So these are things, that's the type of violence that every Black person has to go through. Things probably have changed a little bit since the revolution, but still you have that type of taboos, you know, that society is not willing, you know, to get rid of, because it's all about maintaining oppression and dominance over a marginalized population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I want to learn a little bit about your experience doing this particular exercise. So the first thing I had you do was write a letter. I'm curious what your experience was like writing the letter.
So it was quite kind of weird, and I felt like, oh, what am I going to write, you know? I'm not sure I'm going to keep this letter because I know that I made peace with my mom, so that's it. I mean, like, it's no longer something that I need to go over and over it, because it will become more painful. That I think for healing, I need to progress and try to leave the past behind. So, it was still a good exercise to try and process, you know, some episodes in my life that I'm trying to hide, but I haven't seen psychotherapists in the past, you know, and I haven't talked a lot to a lot of friends who listen to me. Mm-hmm. I think that also was very helpful in my healing process. I may keep the letter, I'm not sure, but I think I can look it up in my mom's eyes and tell her, mm-hmm. you know, that I understand her and that I forgive her. Maybe if I were 15, I could have probably get angry at her, shout at her and tell her, you know, I don't want you. Mm-hmm. Probably should say, I could say to her, I hate you. Mm-hmm. But I think I would feel this kind of peace of mind that I'm facing someone who I made peace with.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it wasn't a disruptive experience.
No, it was not. No, it was, I think, again, I think because of age also, okay. and because of distance, you know, I learned, to forgive and forget about, you know, the pain of the past, because it was the only way for me to heal as a human being. And as a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you say as a woman separately. Can you say more?
Because it's funny because I I rarely identify as a woman. I don't know if it's the appropriate word, but I sometimes forget that I'm a woman. I don't know why. I'm not feminine enough, I guess. But it's just because I was growing up, you know, in a society that was deeply racist. So I was trying to survive as a human being because we were dehumanized as black people, whether men or women. So, so that probably, that experience of racism kind of shaped, you know, the way I look at myself. I was just trying to survive as a human being because I was never considered, I was rarely was considered as a human being. I was considered this exotic creature coming from somewhere. And let alone, you know, being looked at as a woman, as a beautiful woman. Mm-hmm. Because being black in an Arab society is being non-feminine and non-woman. If I speak like this to Tunisians, I would be shocked that I'm speaking like this because I say, oh my gosh, you're so beautiful. I'm like, well, that's not what people back in the 1990s
that's right.
would say about me. They would think of me as something that they can play with, that they can rape, that they can touch because I am not a human being.
Yeah. So for you, it became this experience of like reclaiming first my humanness.
Yeah.
And then maybe at some later point feeling I'm a woman.
Well, I am reclaiming my humanness, which is not easy sometimes, you know, in racist society like this society here in Canada, where being a Muslim with a hijab is not an easy ride. Mm-hmm. And as a woman, again, because ironically and sadly, most of the terrible things, you know, that were visited upon me came mostly from women. And it started from with my mother, but also from, you know, female, quote-unquote, friends, former female colleagues. Mm-hmm. I've witnessed much more violence from them than from men. I decided not to belong to anywhere.
Okay.
I decided to become the free electron.
Okay.
To be different. I'm going to quote a very beautiful verse from a Syrian feminist poetess. Her name is Ghada Saman, and she said, she has probably the most beautiful poem. I was dreaming of one day if I marry someone that I love, I would gift him. Very beautiful verses from this wonderful poetess. She had this poem called, you know, Imar Arabi Hurra, a free Arab woman. And one of the verses, you know, epitomizes, like, represents me. She would say, I decided to rebel against the illogical logic of things. Translated. Yeah. The illogical logic of things in the Arab world, at least, you know, from my own perspective as a person who lived in Arab speaking society, is as a person who happens to be different, and I'm always proud to say I'm different because it makes me beautiful because I'm different. There are logics in the Arab world that you need to follow, which I call arbitrary logics, you know. So these arbitrary logics, you know, dictates what you should be as a woman. So you should put on makeup, which is not my case, unfortunately. I tried. So it's very hard. I would put on makeup twice a year to be seductive and play this seduction game with men, which I'm so bad at it. I tried. It's hard. So you see, these are the arbitrary logics in that the Arab world that we don't follow. If you come from a secular society like Tunisia, so if you are a good Tunisian woman, you should show your hair because a headscarf is only for those, you know, poor, uneducated women of Islamist background. So I'm always projecting some kind of violence in that logic, in that arbitrary logic of things. And this is why, for me, this poet, an Arab poet, a Syrian poet, you know, totally talks to me whenever I feel, you know, kind of down. I just go and, you know, on YouTube and read some of, you know, her poems, because they do ring a bell about how this woman, who comes from a very patriarchal society, had to rebel against that society. And she ended up, actually, she had a lover who was a Palestinian writer, Ghassan Kanafani, and she used to write him letters, and they never married, and she was with another man. So I felt like I should be like Ghada Saman one day, you know, these being string attached, you know, no strings attached with someone who would stifle you. Mm-hmm. But then again, this is just my own, you know, what should I call it? It's not a dream, but it's...
Can we call it a fantasy?
A fantasy, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's this fantasy that sometimes you just hold. You don't necessarily plan on fulfilling, but knowing that she's lived a life like that and that she's written, it does something for you. Could you talk about what it does?
I don't really, I mean, I like her boldness, even though I don't think I will be as bold enough as her, you know, because I still have this traditional thinking in me that I need to be settled with the men, you know, for the sake of, you know, psychological, you know, balance, because I needed that. I need that in my life, at least, you know, as a woman with, you know, physical, you know, sexual needs. But I'm just, you know, thinking, I just think that, you know, this is a type of revolution that we need in the Arab world, to have women who think outside of the box. And me being different, thinking outside of the box, I was policed all the time, policed by secularists, using religion sometimes, you know, to judge me, and by non-secularists using sometimes, again, religion to judge me, to police me. And the reason why I decided to become independent and, you know, to build my own world in which I feel comfortable with, what I could fantasize about things, you know, that I couldn't fantasize if I were in such a society where women are supposed to do this because this is how things should be like, you know, whether as a practicing Muslim, because I as a person who is different, I hold too many contradictory things, you know. I'm a practicing Muslim who fasts, you know, Ramadan, who prays, you know, 5 times a day. That's my own psychological need for some sort of connection to God. But at the same time, that doesn't, you know, preclude me from having a crazy life, you know, sometimes, you know, going out with my best friend. My best friend is an openly gay guy, and I love this guy to death. I mean, you know, this person is like sometimes my kindred spirit, because we get along so much. So I have all these contradictory things according to the, you know, to how society, whether Western society or Arab society, that I'm not supposed to have in this body. And I just say to myself, I'm happy that way. Why should I please society or a world that wants to stereotype me or to police me or to pigeonhole me so that they are happy and they are not, they don't feel secure. Now I understand why I get a lot of bullshit from a lot of women, because of who I am, that I come across as someone who doesn't respond to their fantasies about what a woman with headscarf should be, or what a black woman should be, or what an Arab woman should be, what an African woman, all these, you know, different, you know, identities, you know, mm-hmm. that I have, that all of them, they, you know, live in this body, and they live in harmony, you know. That's something, sadly, that scares a lot of people, in particular women. Men, you know, men too, yeah. Men too, of course, yeah. Because they cannot handle someone who is who has so many contradictory things in them.
Yeah. Is it a fear that, you know, if you exist, then it's going to disrupt the structures?
Absolutely, disrupt the whole system of patriarchy, of feminism, of of the white establishment, of the Arab establishment, of the Muslim establishment, yeah. even of the black establishment, because even among the black community, I'm not black enough for them.
Yeah.
I'm too Arab to be this. And reason why I feel like having deciding to live on my, you know, in my own world, not having this string attached, you know, one of the paths, you know, towards my healing as a person who was struggling with my very complex identity.
Mm-hmm. So say more about that on your path to healing. So just reconciling, accepting.
Exactly.
That was
the different, you know, facets of my life, of who I am, with my personality, that I've learned to accept, you know, that I'm not black enough for a lot of blacks, you know, that I'm learning to accept, to even reconcile with my white heritage, even though a lot of black people would look down on me if I embrace that, because, but that's part of my personality. In the same way, I embrace, you know, my blackness, which is something that a lot of Arabs, they don't like, because I'm supposed to be saved by Islam, not by my blackness. So that's something that will never please anyone. Yeah. And that was very hard. I remember when I decided to accept myself, you know, from the very beginning, and I would cry sometimes, like, why wouldn't people accept me? Oh. And then I'm like, I said, sorry, F these four people. This is me. I mean, yeah. If you're not happy, it's a whole package. You take it or you don't. And yeah. I'm talking about men and women, and women, you know, in the same fashion, because. And I've learned, you know, that the only path, not only for healing, but also for happiness, is to accept who you are and not to change for the sake of others, because I used to try and please everyone. Mm-hmm. And I ended up being so unhappy because I was trying to please everyone, yeah. because I was craving for love, the love that my mother failed to give it to me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, no, I don't have to, because I have my mother. She loves me in her own way. I don't need the love of others.
Yeah, you feel secure in that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I thank mom for that, because she believed in me. She, you know, she took, you know, it's very hard for a mother to let her daughter, her eldest daughter, go and work in a country where there's a war. It's really like, you know, sending your son, you know, if you're a woman, to, you know, to fight for a foreign army.
Yeah.
And I thank my mother for that. She allowed me to pursue my dream and go and live in a country where there was constantly, you know, shootings and, you know, sometimes bombings every day. But then I had to assure her every time to call her mom, I'm okay, don't worry, I'm not doing, you know, I'm fine. And I knew very well that she was suffering, not willing to tell me that she was scared for me, but she still would say, I brought you up, I've done my bit, now this is your life, you do whatever you want. This is, for me now, in hindsight, I feel like that was the biggest proof of love from a mother.
Yeah, because not every mom
does
that.
Yeah. Nope.
Yeah. You know, I'm also really struck because you talked about this feeling of Muslims being angry at you for being saved by blackness, because I'm supposed to be saved by Islam.
It's part of losing one's innocence, because I always crave, you know, my innocent life, you know, when things were so beautiful, when you never worried about how people, you know, I mean, how people could think, just, you know, have your own life where you could daydream all the time. I survived thanks to daydreaming.
Can you say more about that?
You know, I was suicidal back when my father died, around, you know, teenage years. And the only way for me to survive, you know, dark thoughts and suicidal thoughts was just to daydream about things that were almost impossible to fulfill for a black Tunisian girl in the 1990s. I was daydreaming of going to England, and I never told people that I was daydreaming about that, because they would say, oh, no way you're going to do that. I mean, who do you think you are? how would you go there? So I was daydreaming about, you know, meeting Prince Charming, who never came. I was daydreaming about things that were positive and were beautiful. I was daydreaming about Canada back then. Not necessarily Quebec, but still. I was daydreaming about things that were beautiful and positive to escape the terrible and violent society that was it was thrust in, society that never chose, you know, that I was born in accidentally. But also they dreamt when Tunisian Revolution started. That was probably my first romantic connection to Tunisia. And I still hold that romantic connection when I saw people rebelling and calling for freedom. That's the only thing that I feel so strongly and so proud being Tunisian, the revolution that we made against tyranny. And that's my strongest connection, I have to say. Daydreaming about, you know, justice prevailing in a world which is so unfair and so tough on people who are very peaceful and who are non-confrontational like myself.
Yeah. But your dreams, in some way, they like insulated you. They allowed you to keep moving forward until parts of the dreams
have exactly started to control. Like I had to isolate myself from the toxicity of people or things that were around me, and I think it wasn't an easy ride because it had a toll on my mental health at one time, because being around toxic people, sometimes you find it so hard how you can get rid of that toxicity, until I've learned that I'd rather be alone, isolate myself. Until today, I'm most of the time on my own, and I love and enjoy my own company, because it's about reconciling with myself, with my body, with who I am. I'm 42, but I'm reliving my 20s now, because unfortunately I couldn't live my 20s because I was busy struggling to accept myself. I was busy fighting against, you know, violence that I was subjected to. I was busy crying too much because I'm not understanding why people were horrible to me. So now I'm going back to those 20s, trying to relive them in a positive way.
Yeah.
Because I want to just reclaim those years, you know, those youthful years that will never come back. Mm-hmm. And so to be happy again.
Project Apology is brought to you by the Tessalit Institute. It was recorded and edited by me, Arij Elmi, featuring music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you for listening.